Hello all, welcome to HPR. This is Kay Wisher from on the IRC channel. My real name's Kevin Wisher, and tonight I'm joined by an online acquaintance we've never met in person. His name is Honky Magoo, and that's his handle in IRC also. How you doing this evening?
Great. How are you?
Doing good. We've been talking about doing this for a few months now, and we finally got around to getting our stuff together and recording a episode on how we both found and discovered Linux and kind of a history of our venture down the geek highway, so to speak, and how we discovered computers. And so we thought we'd put together an HPR episode tonight and give something for our listeners to for the HPR community to ponder and listen to. I guess I'll get started. Very first exposure to any type of computer was back in 1982. I was a sophomore in high school, and we had a lab of Tandy TRS-80s that they offered a class in. And so I took that class, and I thought, after taking that class, I thought, how are these things ever going to be useful in life? You had to program everything you wanted it to do. I could not understand the basic programming language, or into this day, I can barely understand any type of programming. I can hack my way around a little bit with some HTML and CSS. That's about all I can really do. But what about you, Honky? When was your very first exposure to a computer of any type?
Mine was much later. It was probably about like 92 when I had a it was an IBM XT. It was I forget what the actual name of it was, but it was one of the original portable computers. It was this giant, like massive suitcase-sized computer that sat down. The keyboard would actually go and lift up and attach to where the monitor is supposed to be. It was a little black and orange monochrome monitor, and it was, like I said, it was supposed to be portable, but this thing was huge. It was monstrous. It ran DOS 5. I think I originally was kicking around with a 300 baud modem. It was just an old clunker.
What time period was this?
I was probably using that about 92. I was like around 12 years old, I think. So it was actually a hand-me-down from my father. My father used to use that, and then once he upgraded, I kind of got that from him.
I believe I've seen pictures of that same unit you're speaking of, and like you say, it was not like you say, it was supposed to have been a portable computer, but it was a very large unit and had didn't have a real tiny monochrome screen on it.
Oh yeah. It was tiny little look, the tiny little screen. It was a big old case. I mean, it's bigger than most desktops are right now. And like I said, and then it had like a little handle on it at the very end of it, so it was almost like a suitcase, but it was just massive.
And you say it just ran DOS only, I'm assuming. And what kind of applications and stuff did you do on this?
I can't remember doing a whole lot. My biggest thing was, like I said, I had the 300 baud modem back then. My father originally went on to used it to go on to like Prodigy, and he gave up on that. And when I got it, I started using it to go on to local bulletin board systems. A friend of mine had introduced me to BBSs, and there was a couple of them around. And I would go on to there and go on to their. I mostly just tried to look for different types of files, pictures of stuff, weird little text files. Like I had found the I'm not sure if it was actually the Anarchist Cookbook or it was just called the Anarchist Cookbook, but I found that and had all sorts of weird documents in it about how to make the different types of boxes. They had, oh, I want to say the like the red box, the black box, different ways you can mess with the phone company. I was too young to actually figure out how to use any of that stuff, but it was all interesting stuff to read and look at. They had kind of like forums where you can post messages and stuff like that. It wasn't anything close to like a, yeah, it was kind of like a forum. post conversations and stuff. I'd use that. Applications. Good Lord, very basic text editors that were actually just be able to text to do text files. I want to say I was able to do some very early games on it, but I can't recall. You know, I actually still have the box. I probably should have before we started this busted it open and actually tried to see if I can get it started, but I was afraid of starting a fire because the thing hasn't been touched in ages. There's probably just like all sorts of dust in there.
That'd be interesting to see if it did actually boot up and run.
Right.
Since you mentioned the first, you know, your first actual PC, and my first exposure was a Tandy. I don't even know if you want to consider that a personal computer, but it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't, this was before the IBM clone phase came out. So my actual first exposure to an IBM clone was like in 1990. I'd seen one. I graduated high school and went into an apprenticeship program in the plastic injection trade. And there was the first place I worked where I served my apprenticeship, they had this CAD station, and it was called a Gerber. And it was like, had a 15 inch or maybe a 14 inch monochrome green display, and this two big, huge units that sat underneath the desk. And it was, you know, the one of them was the hard drive, and it was only like a 40 megabyte drive, but it was like in a cabinet, like 3x3x2 foot tall, and had just loud fan running on it. And it was just, you know, one guy that did the CAD work and used it to program our CNC machinery. So, and I didn't even got to touch it. That's the first, you know, real computer I got to see that was doing some neat looking graphics on it. But like I say, it was a monochrome green screen. But you got to see how they made the blueprints on, you know, doing CAD work. So in 1992 was it was when I seen my first, you know, IBM cloned machine at a shop I worked at, that was running AutoCAD on and it was a pretty big monitor at that time. It was like a 17 inch, you know, old, you know, it wasn't, you know, the big hefty monitors. What the heck am I thinking of? Not the LCDs, but the...
Oh, CRT?
CRT, yes. Why can't I think of that? I've been away from them so long, I forget what they're... I'm dating myself.
That's probably a good thing.
And then it also, the system was kind of unique because they had a second monitor setting beside it. It was a like a little 13-inch monochrome monitor that you... typed in using it as an AutoCAD station, you could free up screen space because AutoCAD kind of had a command prompt area where you typed in your commands to initiate drawing lines and stuff like that. Well, they had this little 13-inch monochrome display off to the side and where you did all your inputting of your text commands for AutoCAD. So that was kind of a neat setup. That's what really got me fascinated and wanted to get my first PC. And so I bought a 486 DX33. Was the very first computer I had. It had 1 megabyte of RAM, 120 megabyte hard drive. It was running DOS 5 with Windows 3.1. And I bought that, like I say, to teach myself AutoCAD. And from there, you know, I just did various updates to the that computer. And then I ended up, like I say, I purchased this computer already pre-built. And after that, I started building my own computers. And, you know, I ran through the various flavors of Windows, went from 3.1 to 95 to 98, NT4 I even ran at home for a while because I was doing CAD work, and it kind of required the higher end version of Windows, and then moved on up to Windows 2000 and then XP.
Real quick, just to bring it back a minute, I just wanted to say one thing before I kind of moved up to where you're at. I kind of had exposure to a weird early computer. It was a little Texas, you know, once again, I should have did a quick little search of what the exact name of it was, but it was this little Texas Instrument machine that it played like Atari games and hooked up to the television, but it was basically a computer, and you could run My father had bought a little book on how to program in BASIC, or just kind of some example codes in BASIC. And he had written a couple of games on there on the little TI machine. And he used to use this thing took cassette tapes, like just regular cassette tapes, and that's how it stored all of its data. And I just thought that was interesting as hell. But I also took those books, and later on my XT, I was able to copy over some of the programming in BASIC and ran some of those little programs. I mean, they were just tiny little games like, I don't know, things like guess a number, something that just kind of you type some text out to it and it gives you like an automated response back type of a deal. Then later on, I had finally graduated up to my, I want to say, you'd said back in around 92, was it 92 that you said that you've finally got a 486?
Yes, that was my very first computer.
And I'm not exactly sure whether I had a 486 or a 386, but it was one of the earlier desktop machines that I had used for, I had gotten Windows 3.1 on. And still back in the earlier days, it was pretty much just, it was just kind of the same idea of what I was doing before of, regular personal computing stuff. But with this, I think I was able to get more, I was able to run more things like Meet Pro and Lotus Notes and Lotus 1-2-3. Actually, I don't think I used any of the spreadsheet programs. I just used Meet Pro for the most part for word processing, and then some smaller earlier games, the things that'll run on Windows 3.1. I know I was addicted to, SimCity. I was addicted to SimCity for the longest time.
You mentioned that you were on bulletin boards. That was part of my journey too. That was my first experience of doing anything with a modem. That was kind of interesting. There was the small town I live in. There was actually a bulletin board service that a guy ran, and it was a local number. And I think he actually charged. Well, you could get on for free, but you were limited about, what files you could, you couldn't get full access to all the file archives and stuff on there. But I think if you paid $20 or $25, you got, for a year, you got full access. I can remember browsing, looking for all these little programs and text files and stuff like the same thing you described. It was quite the adventure back then to actually, connect to another computer. But, and this was before pre-internet. I mean, there was no, I don't know when the internet actually first went big, went big, but this is pre-internet. This is just dialing directly into a guy's computer at his house, getting on his bulletin board service.
Yeah. I know there were things like Prodigy available, and then, Prodigy went out, and there was a lot of other things like MSN and AOL, but those were a little bit further down the line. The earlier bulletin board systems that I was on, I was lucky that nobody really wanted to charge you for anything until later on when the internet became more available. Then there was a couple of guys who would charge you for, you were able to go onto the internet or connect to the internet, though I didn't have a web browser, so that looked like hell. But you're able to get onto the internet, but it was only for a limited amount of time. And when it came to file sharing and stuff, we were able to pretty much download whatever you wanted to, but there was always the rule of you have to upload to be able to download something. It was kind of like a weird credit program. And so I was talking about that Anarchist Cookbook text file thing. I think I uploaded that thing more times than I can count to as many places as I can and as many times as I can. I don't know what it is. It's that one thing. I don't know if it was just because that one big file I had, I figured that would probably get me some credit or what, but I uploaded that thing a lot.
Yeah, I've heard of that file, but I don't think I ever actually viewed it.
It was old. Like I said, it was back in the days when people were trying to screw around with the phone company, and it was this. A lot of the stuff that was on there was back when before everything went more fiber optic with the phone lines, and more when it was copper wires and stuff. And so a lot of that made a difference as to how these boxes worked and everything. So, and there was a lot of other stupid things in there too. But like I said, as a young juvenile, it was just fun to read. And actually got me into trouble once, too. I have a feeling that I'm on some sort of a watch list just because I had printed them out and I had them in this like little three-ring binder that I had with me, and I was kind of flipping through when I was in one of my classes back in high school. And then I accidentally left it in the class, and the teacher found it and thought it'd be a good idea to give it to the dean. I got called to the dean's office, and I'm sitting there. And he's like, "Do you know what any of this stuff is?" I go, "Kind of. I know that most of it's out of date, though." It kind of gave me a weird look and just kind of set me on my merry way.
That's funny. My first, you mentioned Prodigy. I can remember using that service, and I think CompuServe at one time was like the first. I don't know if that was officially internet or not, or whether it was just their own service. Like, do you ever remember CompuServe?
Yeah, I think both CompuServe and Prodigy were kind of their own service at that time. I'm not sure whether the internet was around back then, but like I said, a little bit later on, after my father had quit doing Prodigy, they were able to. I know that some of the local BBSs had little things where they can, where you could get onto the internet, but it was just, like I said, it wasn't until later on, until there were more web browsers and stuff like that, that it really was more prevalent.
Yeah, I think that's jogging my memory a little bit. I think CompuServe kind of had the same thing. You could go connect to them, and then you could get certain features through the internet, so to speak. But you had to go through, you had to dial into their service first. And I can remember, you know, even trying AOL at one time. And I think that was my very first experience with the actual internet, was through AOL.
I'm sorry.
Yes. But then, you know, then I think my next internet experience was still using dial up, of course. Local mom and pop ISP started springing up, and I finally got off the AOL and thought, man, this is how even though it was still on dial up, you know, you weren't tied into AOL's, you know, browser and all the crap that comes with it. So you're actually just, you know, using an email client and using a browser. And that was, you know, kind of it was still the same way I'm using the internet now. I mean, but it was just through a 14.4 baud modem.
Yep. And that was the same thing with me. Jumping ahead to probably about, for me, it was 96. I'll be running Windows 95. And I had just, one of the first things I had done when I first started working was, with like my first paycheck, I went down to the local, like you said, mom and pop type of internet service place, and signed up for it. And that was my first real internet. I think as things progressed, I was able to actually, you know, what was it? I think Netscape was the first browser I had ever used. And I think once, you know, I was still able to get to some of the other places, but actually be able to use the browser. But like I said, I'd finally, with my first paycheck, basically got paid for my own internet. And that opened up a whole new world.
Yep. I don't know what we do today without the internet. How far did you get along, you know, on your OS part, OS wise, did you run, you know, what was the last version of Windows that you are or still, you know, are or did run?
I made it up to XP. It was around, let's see, Vista was out, but I never used Vista. Vista was kind of like ME to me. Both Vista and ME just seemed like hokey crap, so I just skipped them. I thought XP ran fine for what I was doing at the time. Then back, let's see, I got the release candidate for 7, and because, I fixed my mother-in-law's computer, and there was something with fighting with the trying to log in to validate Windows, I just said screw it and wound up buying a family key for Windows 7. I don't mind Windows 7. I just really, really, really prefer Linux. But I'll, you know, I'd rather put Windows 7 on somebody's machine than like Vista or XP. I mean, granted, I'd rather give them Linux, but they're not always going to take it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, I guess that kind of, you know, I'm kind of the same way. I ran all the way up to, I've been on about every version of, I've seen every version of Windows and had it actually physically installed on a machine, you know, all the way up to 7. I think the only version I never did run was ME. I skipped that one. So I'll tell you about when I first discovered Linux. This was roughly like in 2006. I'd started taking some college courses in 2005. And I think, you know, like a year later, one of my classes was, and I was in the CIS, the Computer Information Systems program. And one of the classes I took, it had to have been like in my second semester, was a micro operating system class. Okay, my first foray into actually, you know, installing Linux at home was using this Fedora Core 4 that came in this textbook that I had from my college course. And it was because I was having issues with trying to set up a file server on Windows 98. And I couldn't get the file permissions, you know, to, you couldn't lock down anything per user like you can in Linux. So that's why after we actually studied Linux and all of its features, and I finally just installed Fedora Core out of my, you know, off these disks of my textbook onto this computer and learned how to set up a Samba server. This was my very first foray into Linux at all, and it took me quite a few times of wiping the, you know, doing a fresh install each time because I'd get frustrated because I couldn't get Samba to work, and reading various tutorials online, and I finally got it working. And and once I did get it working, I just felt a big, you know, boost in confidence about what you could do with a PC, and it was all free. That's just what blew me away.
Yeah, I'd have to say that was very similar to my first experience when it came to Linux. I was, as you were, I was going to back in, actually, mine was a little bit more recent. I think mine was back in about late 2008, early 2009. I started taking some courses at the local community college for the A+ certification exam. It was a certificate program through the college to be a PC technician, but some of the classes were geared towards taking the A+ certification. Just as a side note, never took the A+ certification. But the part of the class was dealing with operating systems. It was the class, the ones geared towards directly towards the A+ was, one class was geared towards hardware, the other one was geared towards software. And he started talking about the different types of operating systems, the different flavors of Windows, and then talked about Linux. But it even seemed new to him at the time. But he had found a operating system called FreeSpire, which I believe is a derivative of Linspire. FreeSpire was a KDE-based Windows manager, and it was fun and interesting and something completely different. And recently with XP getting so just, it drove me nuts because as we were discussing earlier about using all of those older operating systems for with Windows, I don't know about you, but we had like one version of DOS for like the whole entire family and friends. We had one version of Windows 3.1 that we shared with just about everybody. We had one version of 98 ME, whatever. We had one version that we had pretty much used for everybody's computer. If like all of a sudden you had to reinstall the operating system, no big deal. You know where the disk is. Dad's got the disk. He's down there. You do it. Go stop by Dad's house. Pick up the disk for that, you know? And then XP came around, and they got so tight and so hard when it comes to those keys that, you know, that you have to install it and you have to make sure that everything's registered and stuff. And that just became, it didn't seem right to me. And for so many years, I've been using operating systems free. I mean, it's the operating system. It's the base system that you're running all this stuff on. It shouldn't be, you know, that so tight and bogged down. It's just the base system. And they make it so they all of a sudden Windows Microsoft decided they were going to make it so difficult just to be able to use the operating system. And this just blew me away. And I just, you know, this was like XP had been out for a little while. And, you know, actually the XP had been out for a while and we had already gotten into Vista. But it was just struggling with that for the longest amount of time to find this free operating system, actually called FreeSpire. It was just, it was so neat and so cool. And it was, just, I started playing around with it. And one of the first things that struck me was, to be able to take these classes at the community college, I had to use Microsoft Office, but it was, you know, Office type programs, and I didn't have Office. I had downloaded OpenOffice, but with OpenOffice, the version I had downloaded for Windows straight from the OpenOffice website, I wasn't able to open the newer version of Office files, the DOCX files. Somehow, magically, the OpenOffice that came standard installed automatically, which was another great thing, all these programs installed automatically on the very first install, was able to open DOCX, the EXE, X files, whatever.
It was able to... XLSX, I think.
Yeah. It all was able to open it just by default. So automatically I was dual booting, which, by the way, I had no idea. I was thinking about this recently. I can't recall, like, dual booting if I can remember right, didn't seem like a new thing to me when I first started FreeSpire, but I can't recall why or if I had ever dual booted beforehand. And that one's going to bug me for a while. I don't know whether I'd run I don't know, 95 and 98 at the same time or something, and had ran a dual boot or what. But so I was dual booting for the longest time between FreeSpire and Windows XP. But after a while, it got to a point where I really wasn't going into XP for anything except for one program I was using at the time, which was making DVD copies legally. There were DVD copies, the DVDs that I own. I was just making copies of them for my own archives. But that was about the only reason I would ever go back into XP, and that's just because I really didn't look too closely as to trying to find something exactly like that for FreeSpire, because FreeSpire was initially starting to get their it kind of ran up until I want to say version 2.08, and I want to say that I don't quote me on that, I'll check it out later, but and then it just kind of stopped, and they were trying to put something together like a software center, not unlike the Ubuntu software center. But it was kind of slow going, and it was a kind of shaky. But I think they had like Synaptic or something like that also on there, so that I was still able to find software besides their little software center to be able to install. And it just, like I said, it automatically had everything that I wanted right there on the first install. And then this was the big kicker for me. Talking about in the class and stuff about how Linux is and how it's all free, open source, and it's configurable, it kind of piqued my interest as to what can I do with this thing. And I all of a sudden got a little bug in my head as to... down on the bottom left-hand corner, you know the little KDE symbol? Is that K with the little gear? It had that as its little start menu. I got a little bug in my head. I went like, I want to change that into Tux. Don't know where that came from. Just all of a sudden decided, I want to change that little start icon into Tux. So I went searching around online, and I found where it is that they keep the icons for that theme. So I went in there and I just renamed all the icons from the the start menu or whatever to just swap the names between Tux, the little Tux icon, and that little K-gear. And all of a sudden, I restart the thing up, and down in the bottom left-hand corner, guess what? Tux. And as an added bonus, the little pointer, when it does its little thinking, you know how normally you get like the little hourglass, whatever? It was Tux. He was doing a little squash, and stretch. Little Tux, kind of squashing in the middle of the screen. I'm like, that is cool. I was never able to do this something like this with Windows before. So not only did I get everything pretty much that I needed right on the first install, I can configure this thing to make it look like and do whatever I want it to do. That is just awesome.
I agree. And yeah, and trying to, I don't know if that can be done on Windows, and I don't really care, but I'm sure somebody can tell you that it probably can be done on Windows, but whether you can, where it's as easy to do, you know, on Linux as it is, I doubt it. You'd probably have to install a third-party application to do something like that.
I think you did. I think the teacher of that class was actually showing off something where he can configure stuff by some add-on thing that he bought or something for Vista. And and the fact that I could just do that just by digging around and changing the name of some files, I just thought that was awesome.
Speaking of Vista, that brings me to my next point about, you know, how I, you know, me discovering Linux was after, from the time I bought my first computer already pre-built and then doing upgrades and various custom builds myself between that time and whatever year, you know, whatever year Vista was available in store-bought and PCs. I don't know why I decided I was just going to buy a store-bought and PC instead of building my own at this time for my next upgrade. So happened to be in the local Sam's Club. I don't know if those are popular in your area or not, but they're kind of like a big wholesale club membership, Costco-type store, and they had computers in there, and they had some on sale. It was an HP computer. I don't remember what processor and specs it had, but it came with Vista. And I know, I'm sorry, you're going to say, I'm sorry. Vista was the worst operating, one of the worst operating, you know, one of the versions of Windows that's what every other version's a pig or a flop, you know. So, and I brought it home, got it all hooked up, and I had this older flatbed scanner that was no longer supported in this brand new operating system, and I could not use this scanner. And it was all because, you know, just wasn't going to be supported no more in Windows. And so I ended up wiping Vista off of it, putting XP on it, and come to find out after I put XP on it, I couldn't, the drivers were no, for this computer, the XP drivers were not available for some of the things. Or maybe it was, and I was dual booting XP and Vista, and I'd have to go back into XP just to do some scanning. And I thought, well, why not? Let's just try Linux on it. So I ended up, you know, reconfiguring, dual booting the system with, I think, XP and I think Linux Mint 5 was my first foray into a desktop, you know, for a workstation, on my personal workstation. And when you know, come to find out, you know, the old scanner I had was still supported, and I'm sure it is still today. The only reason I'm not using it anymore is I happened to purchase a newer printer that had is an all-in-one unit that already had a scanner in it. But I'm sure that same scanner would still work today if I plugged it in. So that was something else that just, you know, drove me to Linux was the, some people say, you know, that your hardware, some people's downfall of Linux is because hardware is not supported. But the selling point to me was that my older hardware was working in Linux and it wouldn't work in Windows.
Yeah, and to that same point, I never understood when people would tell me that Windows just works, because it doesn't just work. It just works if you buy it straight from the store and you bring it home and it's the thing that's automatically installed on the machine, then yes, it's automatically installed on the machine at that time. It just works. But if anybody who has ever installed a Windows operating system from default, just like buying a Windows XP disk and putting it in a random machine and then trying to and then doing a saying a little prayer and hoping that you have all the drivers that you need for that machine. And the first one being, you better hope that you have the network card or whatever the modem or network card being the first one, because then you can actually go and download all the drivers that you need, hopefully from the manufacturer site. But if you don't have that one, then you are just SOL, because that's that's the worst thing. And you sit there and you go over to the settings thing and just sit there and go through the different yellow triangles that are there and go, yep, I gotta go find the driver for this, and yep, I gotta go find the driver for that, and how come my screen is so freaking big? One of the reasons. I mean, I going back to the project I did for my mother-in-law, I fixed her computer, I had cleaned it up, and I had put like Vista on it, and when I did, it did something. It didn't like the original the video card that was originally on that machine, and so I could not for the life of me get it past like 800 by 600 or something. It was just massive, bulky, and ugly. It didn't recognize it, and so I actually had to go out and purchase a video card just to be able to get Vista to run right. I don't know. It just baffles me that when people say things like Windows just runs. No, it does not. It is a struggle at times. There are times when it runs just fine with a lot of the drivers that are automatically on there, but it is not just run just fine by default.
Yeah, I know. I run into that. I do side work at home on repairing computers, and even today, if you install Windows 7, unless you're installing if you have a name brand computer like Dell or HP, unless you use the restore disk that came with that computer, you're going to have like what you described. You're going to have driver issues, and you got to go. And if you don't have another computer to go out and find those drivers, you know, you're going to have to go to a friend's house and download the drivers for various things. And usually the NICs or NICs and video cards I find are the ones that usually can't recognize right off the bat.
Yeah, it can get scary when you're installing from scratch. Quick question, real quick. You were trying to set up you were using 98 to try to set up network file sharing. Didn't you say you also had worked around with NT though?
Yeah, I had NT 4.0 at one time, and that was because I was doing side work at home doing CAD work, and the CAD package I had recommended using that over I think Windows 95, and since it was the enterprise version of Windows or whatever, and I guess I could have went that route, but I just didn't, and I was just frustrated with Windows at that time. And I still am today.
I understand fully. Again, I mean, I don't want to push the topic more, but when did you recognize that Windows had the Windows Workgroup, the peer-to-peer networking thing? Was that actually, did they push that into XP, or was that still back in the earlier, it might have been like ME or something?
I believe they came out with a 90 Windows 3.1 came out with a Windows. It was called Windows 3.1 for work groups. I think that's when work groups actually showed up on the scene. Was in Windows 3.1.
Because isn't that sort of the same idea of it's like a peer to peer network. Like when I was using 3.1, trust me, I wasn't doing any networking. Good Lord, all I had was a little dial up modem, and we were just dialing out every once in a while.
Yeah, I didn't experience any, home networking until that time period I mentioned. And I think it was, Windows 98 period. And I think I even tried doing it with Windows 2000 before I finally put Fedora on that machine. And it just, even with Windows 2000, it just, you couldn't get the full control like you could over with the Linux system with file permissions and shares, and it just became difficult, and it always seemed like the shares would break on Windows, and it was just a big headache.
You're right. I think thinking back, it was about 98 when I well was no Windows XP. I'm sorry. It was around Windows XP that I actually started playing around with a with actually networking. That's when I probably when I first moved into this house here, probably about 11 years ago or so. I decided that I was gonna. We were me and my roommates decided we were gonna basically network the house, and I think we started using the Windows peer-to-peer networking to do file sharing and stuff like that, and it was a lot of fun doing gaming.
So after the FreeSpire, what was your ventures down on Linux Road? What distros have you tried and played around with?
Well, right around the same time as he had given us, well, he had actually given us a disk for FreeSpire because one of the things from the class was to do an install, and he also gave us disks for Ubuntu and Kubuntu, and so I had actually installed both of them. I was a KDE fanboy for a long time. But I don't know, after a while, KDE just kind of seemed bloated and heavy. And so I kind of stuck around with regular Ubuntu for a while, right up until actually the point of the switch from GNOME 2 into Unity. Just because Unity had done, I probably would have stuck around with it longer, but it started to get kind of heavy on my system. And I had. I don't know. I was running older hardware, and it all of a sudden, when I did an update on Ubuntu, it switched over to Unity, and all of a sudden, my network file sharing or something broke on it on that version. So I just kind of went, ah, what the heck? Basically, anytime I would break something in Linux, I would go, ah, let's try a new distro. So I went to and in that, and it didn't help that I would always get the oh, what is it called? Linux Format Magazine. Yeah,
Yeah.
Linux Format Magazine. I mean, for the longest time, that was my my biggest thing with Linux was. I mean, it was before I had found the different podcasts and the forums and IRC, which is my biggest connection to the Linux community was that Linux Format Magazine. And I mean. Good Lord, the back of that book with the back of that magazine where it has all the articles of people's writing in questions and stuff like that. Those were just, I mean, those were invaluable. I mean, and so with that magazine, I would find different distros and stuff like that, and I would just every time I would screw around and break something, I would just go, "Eh, let's install a new distro." And I've bounced around from a lot of Ubuntu-based systems, mostly because with my older hardware and my older hardware has a wireless network card that isn't always. You can't always see it. It's not, I don't know, it isn't supported by default by a lot of distros, but it is supported by default by Ubuntu. So any type of Ubuntu derivative, be it, I used Bodhi for the longest time because I'm a big fan of E17 Enlightenment. I used Mint and that all the things like that. It just, they just work, you know.
Like I mentioned, I think my first, install on my main desktop rig was Mint 5, and I just kind of been a Mint fan for a number of years up until lately. I think my last install was Mint 14 actually on this system here that I'm currently running, and I've tried some different derivatives of Debian. I think Solus OS. There was the Linux Mint Debian edition I ran for a long time. Then there was another offshoot. It's called SolidX, and they make a XFCE and KDE version. And I don't know. I've been on the Debian based and Ubuntu based systems for so long. I'm kind of getting tired of them. I've been wanting to try to expand my horizons, so to speak, and here maybe about a month ago, I finally gave Manjaro a try, which is an Arch-based. I kind of compare it to the being the Linux Mint of the Arch distros. It's very easy friendly installer. You don't have to. It's not like installing Arch from the command line and building it up from scratch. It's pretty much ready to go once you walk through the, go through the graphical installer. That's very similar to other distros, and I'm really finding it stable. And Pac-Man Package Manager and the Arch Wiki, even though it's not straight Arch, is very useful with Manjaro since it's based off Arch. So anything you want to usually install and learn about the Arch and Pac-Man and configuring Arch, you can find, even though, like, say this is Manjaro, you can find through the Arch Wiki. The Arch Wiki's, and even on other distros, it's the Arch Wiki I find is very helpful in learning things. But I also have been running my own Myth TV system for years, using Linux for that. I've got two systems in the house, one on my main TV. It's using my Comcast cable for the unencrypted channels that I can pick up. And then I also have a system out in my garage that has a antenna hooked to it that's up in my attic that captures, records video off the over-the-air stuff. So I'm fully ingrained in Linux. Now my main system, I'm no longer dual booting. I've got my wife off of Windows pretty much. We still have, the kids have some Windows laptops, of course, but I've just, on my main system now, I just have a Windows 7 VM for some particular, a Hallmark, basically it's for a Hallmark card program that my wife likes, and I can't find a replacement on Linux for creating greeting cards like she likes. And I'm currently taking a Microsoft Access class that I have to have that for. So that's basically the only thing I use my Windows VM for anymore at home. Is I've pretty much found replacements in the Linux and open source world to do everything I need to do. And very, like I say, just very seldom have to use Windows.
Yeah, going back a little bit, one of the greatest things I've found, right now, I've settled on straight Debian, and I've been playing around a lot with that. But one of the greatest things to about Ubuntu, well, about Linux, is just the whole idea of the package managers and the package repositories and stuff like that. Going into a Windows machine and then going to, and trying to find different places to download all of these files and programs and stuff like that. Like I always went to some a place called File Hippo, and I usually had a lot of the things that I needed. But it's so easy just to go into a drop down into a terminal, get root access, and just type apt-get and then just whatever the package name is, and just have it install right on your system. It is just, oh, it's so easy. It's so, oh, that's why I like Linux so much. It's so configurable. It's so easy. I can just go straight in. I can just download when I can have a whole operating system with everything that I need, probably up and going and like no time flat. It's just easy.
I agree, and one of the major pluses about Linux that you mentioned, all the software that you get, but when you do your regular system updates, all the application that you install on top of that distro get updated along with it. I mean, on Windows, you have to go to every, if a software package has an update, you have to go download a new version. You may have to uninstall the old version first. You just can't upgrade it, or you may have to do, stand on one leg and hop on the other to get it to work. It's just, Linux is just so easy. You just, a couple commands, app, like you say, on Debian-based systems, apt-get update and apt-get upgrade, and it updates everything, the OS, all your software, and it's just so easy.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. Real quick, I had you said you were using Myth TV. How is that working out for you? I only ask because when I've originally looked at the idea of Myth TV, a lot of the back end stuff that I saw, maybe it's just because I was getting my original stuff from the Linux Format magazine, which is a British magazine, but most of the stuff seemed to say that they couldn't that you had to pay for a subscription to get the what all of the channels are and what all an update of what time all the programs are and stuff like that. And I think that was why I never wound up trying to do that the Myth TV before, was I didn't want to have to pay for something like that, and I didn't know whether I can download that from somewhere or oh, just quickly, what's been your experiences with Myth TV?
Oh, it's been great. The service you're speaking of, yes, you do have to pay for the channel guide to get all your channel guide information. And when I first started, it was $20 a year, and I think they just up my and I've just last year when I did my subscription update, they raised it to $25 for a year. So it's nothing, outrageous to pay for this service, and you get it goes out and downloads all the schedules, the TV schedules for you when you have to have, well, you don't have to have it, but it just makes it so much easier to have.
Right, because without it, you don't have the like program name. You just have basically you're just choosing a time that you wanted to continually record.
Right, and like it has the main back end of Myth TV has a web GUI interface that I can look at a listing of the program listings and choose programs to record and how you want to handle those recordings. And it's very daunting the first time you set it up, but now I can get if I wipe my main system, and I can get my Myth TV system back up and running pretty much in a couple hours. It's not that difficult anymore for me, but I don't have to do that very often, maybe every 2 years. I try to base it on a long-term support Ubuntu. Right now I'm running on the main system Zubuntu, the XFC version with the Myth TV added on to it. The whatever the last long-term support version was, so that I don't, so I don't have to worry about, and I don't care about all the latest updates on it. I mean, I keep it up to date, and I very rarely use it for anything else but the Myth TV. I don't. Sometimes, my wife will use it for Pandora if she's working around the house and she just wants to have some music playing through it's connected to my home stereo system, so she'll fire up Pandora to play some music while she's working around the house.
That's pretty cool.
It's very well worth playing around with. If you're going to get into it, what type of TV server? I mean, we could do a whole HPR broadcast show on just Myth TV.
Right.
But it all depends on what you're wanting to do. I mean, if you're just wanting a media, like an HTPC, a home theater PC that you don't need DVR functionality, then you don't need Myth TV. There's other packages where you can do XBMC and other, like a front end for your own digital media, like home movies, pictures, and your ripped content and stuff like that. And I think, and I'm not sure about whether you can interface to like Hulu and Netflix and stuff like that because I never used it, but there's all kinds of ways to get if you want to cut the cord completely or whether you're not, but Myth TV is basically if you don't, it's a DVR. It's a replacement for a set-top box for a digital, video recording. So if you're not into recording TV shows, then you're pretty much don't need Myth TV.
Right, and I am because I've been using TiVo for about I don't know, at least a good, well, 8 years now, 7, 8 years. And if I can have that networked to all that, have a one solid back end and have that networked to all the televisions in the house, then that would be invaluable.
Yeah, you can do that. You just have a, it doesn't take a very beefy system to run a back end, to do all the recording. You just need a lot of disk space, depending on the type of tuners you have and what type of, if you're recording HD content, it takes about 6 gigabytes for an hour show. So you have to take into account, the file storage of the recordings. And the best thing going today is a device made by Silicon Dust. It's called an HD Home Run. They make different models, but it's a network-based tuner. You don't even have to open up your computer to add it. You just hook it up to power and hook it up to your network, and it has the tuners built right into it. And you don't even Myth TV recognizes it, and like I say, it makes things a whole lot easier just hooking up this network-based tuner.
Nice.
Well, we're coming up on an hour now. Do you think do you have anything else you want to add, or do we consider this good?
Well, not unless we want to talk briefly about servers or whatever, but we are coming up to an hour, so we guess we can just kind of cut it off at the how we first get into Linux and then how we first got into desktop Linux.
Yeah, I think we'll stop there. Maybe we'll do a part two later on down the road. So for now, this has been Kevin Wisher, K Wisher on IRC, and Honky Magoo. Honky, you want to say good night?
Have yourself a marvelous evening and thanks for listening.
Good night, everyone, and thank you for listening to HPR.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.